Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Well, it was a week of many firsts in the political world. Now, you can probably imagine this year has been crazy. I think I've said it at least 10 times now on this podcast. Another big week of big news in the political world. But we're really starting to see in this year, there is a massive amount of political news that really is altering to the political system as we know it. It's going to be interesting when we do the year in review in December of like all the big stories. It's going to be hard to narrow this all down, but we'll do that for you, and it's going to be really interesting, that's for sure. But let's talk about the big first here that is going to lean into next week, and that is the fact that Kevin McCarthy has been ousted from the speakership, marking the first time in history this has ever happened. It's never happened before, believe it or not. There was a motion to vacate the chair, which is it's the fancy name for vote the guy out. They tried this in the 1900s, but it didn't succeed. This is the first time it's actually worked, and by members of his party, no less. So with that in mind, this is very monumental when thinking about it in terms of the landscape that we are dealing with right now. So 8 Republicans, along with all the House Democrats, voted McCarthy out. Those 8 included Florida Republican Matt Gaetz, Montana's Matt Rosendale, Arizona's Andy Biggs. Then you have Eli Crane on there too, and Colorado's Ken Buck, South Carolina Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Tennessee's Tim Burchett, and Virginia's Bob Good. Now, I want to talk about this list for a second here, because you might be listening to them and be like, hey, don't some of those people sound familiar? Well, yes, because a lot of those people were the very same people that opposed McCarthy the first time. In fact, a couple of them on this list went right up to the very end and didn't vote for him. Either they voted present or they voted in the no column, but either way, they weren't in the McCarthy camp then and clearly aren't there now. Then there are some other interesting people on this list, like Nancy Mace. She was with McCarthy all the way throughout that process back in January. But now she flips sides, claiming he didn't do enough for women's rights. So more of an attack from the center and the left of his caucus, while all these other people are attacking him from the right. So he was getting it on all sides, clearly. And also Tim Burchett, you may remember him, the UFO guy. He's the guy who organized and called for and arranged the UFO hearing. So that's his big claim to fame. And you got a couple of Freedom Caucus members on here as well. It'll be interesting to see what happens to these people. Now, Gaetz in particular, he's the guy who called for the motion. This is after where you might have remembered that story last week. We didn't get to really touch on it in the show, but where they very, very narrowly avoided a government shutdown. And it was because McCarthy, at the end of the day, went to the Democrats and put a compromise deal together to pass it through the House, get it through the Senate, and the President's desk in time to avert one. So, these Democrats, you know, they weren't too thrilled with McCarthy, but the Republicans, they were all pissed off that he even worked with the Democrats. So they said, screw this, we're getting him out of there. Well, that was the Gaetz logic anyways. And some of these other people in this, like Rosendale and Biggs and those type of guys, they were not too keen on that. But the irony is, Gaetz had to go to the Democrats in order to get this done, because obviously 8 is not enough compared to like 200 plus members that liked McCarthy. So they had to go do a deal, I guess, shall you say, with the devil in order to get the thing done. So there's that. So you might say to yourself, oh, well, maybe McCarthy will run again. Well, shortly after that, McCarthy held a press conference where he said, nope, he's done. He's calling it quits. He will not be seeking the speakership again. So this leaves the Republican conference searching for a new leader. Interim Speaker Patrick McHenry has scheduled a candidates forum for Tuesday and expects a vote. We can expect this vote on the House floor on Wednesday. So it'll be interesting to see who gets in, who gets out, and who actually is in this thing when it's all said and done and when the votes go down. So far, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise and Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan are the announced candidates. But they're not the only ones who are considering thinking about this right now. Now, it's important to note before I get to the speculation that Scalise is the front runner going to this thing because of the fact that he is the House Majority Leader. That is the second in command there in the Republican caucus, right under the Speaker. So essentially, it's a succession plan. He's a McCarthy ally, was with him thin and through, and this is the guy that McCarthy would probably like to see get in there. But again, you got Jim Jordan there too. Jim Jordan, beloved by the conservative movement. He is the chair of the Judiciary Committee that famously investigating the Justice Department. He's really all into that. Questioning Merrick Garland, going after the Hunter Biden investigation. These are things that conservatives like. And if you're trying to fundraise, you want a guy people like. He's a pro-Trump guy. Him and Trump get along pretty well. So, if you're putting that all into consideration, and a lot of people in conservative media also like the guy, Jordan may fare better than a lot of people expect. So we're going to have to see where that goes. But again, these are not the only guys who are thinking about getting this race. Now, as of this podcast, Jim Jordan and Steve Scalise are the only ones in this race. This is of the recording of it. That could change. I encourage you to check the sources, especially over the weekend. We might have a surprise candidate get in there. Maybe someone's going to be thrown in at the last minute. As you may recall, there were like 5 or 10 different names thrown into consideration on the House floor back in January when all people were voting whatever they wanted. People were Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, you know, Winnie the Pooh, all this type of stuff. Well, Winnie the Pooh. I mean, you know what I mean. Some of those weren't quite on there. But you had heard Donald Trump's name brought up. Then there was Byron Donalds. He was there for a while. Jim Jordan got some votes. Lee Zeldin. There are a decent amount of names that were brought up for House votes. So it could be possible someone gets thrown in there. So Kevin Hearn, he's the head of the House Republican Study Committee, which is the largest group in all of Congress. So he's got a pretty large brain. They're basically the ones who come up with the policies and the rules and all that type of stuff. And he's thinking about a run. So if he gets in, then, you know, that could make things interesting. Although he's not a household name, I'm sure a majority of you listening to this don't know him and may have only heard him a little bit because his name was also thrown out there during the speaker's race in January. He got a couple of people who are interested in him. So with that in mind, he could be thinking, maybe I got a shot at this thing. And the strange one, but his name was thrown in January, so maybe not too strange, is Donald Trump. His name was invoked. People, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, have said he would make a great speaker. Well, Trump was asked about that, and he said, I'm more focused on my presidential campaign. But he didn't rule it out either. He said he'll do whatever is good for the country. Now, there are some sources that are out there that are speculating that he may go to rally everyone behind Jim Jordan. We're going to have to see if that's true. But if it is, that would be very significant because, as you know, the former president was the guy who got McCarthy over the finish line last time. So if he got everyone behind Jordan, that might pressure Scalise to get out. Because just because people are in it right now doesn't mean they're going to stay in it. Is there going to be a side deal? Because right now, under the Scalise plan, Tom Emmer, who's currently the House Majority Whip, third in command, he would try and get the second place spot, which would be House Majority Leader, which is the spot Steve Scalise has now. So the pecking order would be in the Scalise speakership. The first spot would be Scalise. he would get the big prize. He'd be House Speaker. Then down would be the House Majority Leader, which would be Tom Emmer. And then you got some other spots where you got to negotiate. And, you know, the rumor is that Elise Stefanik, who is the chair of the House Republican Caucus, that she's looking to get a promotion to possibly a whip. So maybe her name would get thrown in there under that scenario. Well, here's the deal that could possibly come. If Jordan gets the speakership, he would let Steve Scalise, Majority Leader, and Tom Emmer, Majority Whip. Maybe that would be the plan. And that might be enough to get enough votes over. Maybe they lose someone. Let's say Elise Stefanik, for example. Although she's usually one who kind of keeps in with the caucus. But let's say it's her. She's like, you know what? I didn't get my promotion. Screws. I'm not voting for Jordan. And then, you know, as long as everyone else comes along, she's good. Because there would have to be three other people that would join Stefanik in order to really trigger any trouble for Jordan or the House conference. Because if they want to avoid the freak show that they had last time around, they're going to want to do a lot of behind closed doors on Tuesday, because they essentially pick who they want to be their quote-unquote nominee. They're doing a lot of this at the candidates forum after everyone's spoken and all the members got to hear from them, ask questions. Then they're supposed to, in theory, vote on this. But we'll see what happens there. And it'll be a question if they can't agree, are they going to push that vote further out? But right now, it's important to note, the government cannot function, at least on the House side, while this is going on. There's no speaker in place. They can't do anything else. All they can do is keep considering the speaker. So if they don't pick someone within the next week, that could jeopardize potentially the government spending bill, because under the agreement that was made last weekend, they only have 45 days. That was from the moment that was signed by Biden. So let's do some math here. That would probably put it closer to, depending on when you listen to this, between 30 and 35 days, a little more maybe, but around there. Again, if it drags on, it will be less than 30 days. So they're going to have less than a month to negotiate all this complicated spending stuff. It's going to be a task if they don't get this done. So a lot of these members are probably going to want to get this out of the way, done, and not have to think about it anymore. So they can focus on negotiating funding, because as you know, that was a big deal. We didn't get to cover it on the podcast because it was happening too much in the moment. So, and there was a lot of news last week too. We're going to have to see how the speaker's race and who is the speaker, because some people are worried if it's Jim Jordan, he may not want to negotiate with Democrats as much, which would cause a shutdown. But then if it's Scalise, some people are concerned maybe he's going to negotiate too much with Democrats. We're going to have to see. We're really going to have to see. And the interesting thing about Jordan is he's a guy who, as you may recall, he was nominated for Speaker a while back. And he said he didn't want it. Even days leading into that vote to vacate the chair, he was like, I don't want this thing. I really don't. But then he was asked the night it all happened, Jim Jordan, are you going to run? Well, that's going to be a decision for the conference. Notice this shift? He shifted. Then what happened the next day? Probably only about 12 or 13 hours later after he was asked about that. He announced his bid for speakership. So something happened there. It's the Paul Ryan effect. You may remember Paul Ryan. He was a guy who was the head of the budget committee. He was all excited about that. He loved the job. He had a young family. And he was content with just doing that. But John Boehner had an epiphany moment with the Pope. The Pope was visiting at the time. And the House Freedom Caucus was not too thrilled with him. They kind of were looking to pull the same thing that they did to McCarthy. They were trying to do it back then. Saw the writing on the wall. I was like, you know what? Okay, I'm just going to resign. He not only resigned from the speakership, he resigned from Congress altogether. So that left House Republicans having to pick a new person. And they all seemed to like Paul Ryan. They all were begging him, please run, Paul. Please run. Please run. Because Kevin McCarthy was expected to be the guy. But then they asked him. They pushed him out of the race. because they had all these concerns. They were digging up this dirt on him. And then he had some faults. He was on Hannity and said some stuff that they didn't really like. So he was gone. And as a result, he had to drop out. And Paul Ryan had to take the mantle and be the speaker that he never wanted to be, but felt like he had to be. So he ended up taking that mantle on as speaker. So we could be seeing the same thing happen to Jordan right now. We'll watch the situation and see where this all goes and who gets picked. Maybe it will be former President Trump. We'll have to see. But former President Trump has got a lot going on for himself. He's on trial for fraud in New York. New York Attorney General Letitia James is suing the former president, along with his three adult children, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric, for inflating the value of his real estate properties in New York City, in New York State, as well as Florida. Let me explain. So these properties include the Park Avenue property, where Ivanka had a penthouse in New York City, then Trump Tower. Also, Mar-a-Lago was in there too, and even the Trump Organization itself. Now, to note with Ivanka, she's no longer really in the fold here because based on an appeal judge that a ruling over the summer basically said that the statute of limitations had expired for her part of the case and said, you can't sue her anymore. This is over. So she's no longer a part of it. So it's just Trump, Don Jr., and Eric who are under the microscope right now by this attorney general and by this judge. And it's important to note, this is a civil case. So no one's going to do any jail time here. So they can only be found liable, meaning that they are guilty of doing this. They can't be guilty or criminally convicted and all this type of stuff. That's not what this kind of trial is. This is just a civil trial. There's not even a jury. It's all done, going to be done in front of this state Supreme Court Justice, Arthur Anagorin. So under him, he's going to be the one listening to the whole thing. And he's going to be the first and last word on everything. So Anagorin is the guy who is going to be determining whether Trump is going to get out of this or not. And we might have already had a little indicator on that because he's already ruled that he is liable for fraud. Now, that is being appealed currently by the Trump team, but this was a pretrial ruling. I know, a little confusing, that he had to do on certain parts of the case and the lawsuit addresses certain other parts of it. So it's all like two separate things, but they're all kind of together. It's a complicated legal mess right now that the former president and his family are in. They're trying to get themselves out of it. The judge said to clear the schedule until December 22nd. So all the attorneys for Trump have to be in that courtroom for that. But Trump doesn't have to be there. It's, you know, you're welcome to. But in a civil trial in New York, you do not have to be there. But he decided to go anyway for a couple days, just to see what the action was all about. It was 2.5 days because on Wednesday he went for the morning session and then he left, got on a plane, got back to Mar-a-Lago, and away he went. And Eric Trump did not show up on Thursday either for the case. So they were not planning on staying for the whole time. I mean, you know, there was a rumor that they were going to stay for the whole week. They were going to go, but, you know, there was a lot of things that happened that probably altered that decision. We're going to go through all those cases for sure here. Now, let's talk about what happens if he's found liable, right? Because that's the big question. What is this going to do? Fraud, inflating property values, what does that even amount to? Well, here's the deal. If he is found liable, he could be at risk of losing his business license in New York. So the ability to practice and to run a business in the state of New York, he might not be allowed to do that anymore. None of the Trumps. They'd have to move it out. They'd probably have to move to Florida or some other state. That would allow them to run the Trump Organization. So they are there. And then, for what they do get to keep there, they would lose control of the properties in the state. So there's some properties up in Westchester that he owns, as well as something on Wall Street that, yeah, you might be able to own it, but you're not going to be able to run it. And if you're able to, you may not be able to own that either. You may have to give it back to the state, and they're going to have to do a sell-off process. You know, he's going to lose some money there. And then he's going to be forced to pay up a hefty fine of $750 million. A lot of money on the line for the Trump family. Nearly $1 billion, if not more. And if you add all this stuff up. So they're going to have a lot to deal with here if they continue on this path to where you may not get what they want. So they're going to try and appeal. All this. And I bring in the billion part because one of these assets, and two, because of all the attorney fees that are going to be spent on this. This is millions and millions of dollars that's going to take to appeal, as well as the trial in general, because based on the rulings that we've seen from these people, probably not, they may not go in Trump's direction. So he may have to appeal. And appeals take a long time, they take a lot of money, and they take years. So he's going to have to hang in tight there for all of it. Now, in terms of Trump and where this goes politically for him, well, that's a question, because we don't know how much he's actually going to be able to say going forward, and depending on how much he crosses the line here. Now, the reason why Trump may not really be at the trial anymore is because the judge issued a gag order in the case. So, basically, the judge said, you know, warn people, hey, you shouldn't be talking about my staff. I don't want you doing that. Don't discourage them. I don't care who you are, whether you're Trump or Letitia James. You can't be doing that. Letitia James, the attorney general. And, well, Trump decides to post a photo on Truth Social of the main clerk, who's been literally right by the judge's side the whole time, a picture of them with Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, and also one of the senators from that state, posing and implying that there's this kind of Democratic influence and that this process is politically corrupt. And he has repeatedly called this a political witch hunt, this whole case. So after that, the judge was like, nope, I'm done. No more talking about this, members of my staff. But Trump decided the loophole in it and went and talked to the media after that about the judge himself and Letitia James, the attorney general. But he didn't touch the staffers and all that. He kind of left them out of it for the most part. But again, the ability to communicate the information may determine how well he does and what the American people get to see out of this. Because right now, the polling's looking pretty good for him. But whether that sticks is the question, and we're going to have to see. Now, this isn't the only legal thing that we're watching. We got to bring it across the river, back from New York. Let's bring it a little over to New Jersey, Union City. We're even going up north into Bergen for this one, because there's more revelations about the Menendezes that we have to talk about. And I'm not just talking about the senator. I'm talking about his wife, Nadine. She is now dealing with a resurfaced story that could just make things a lot more complicated for them in this indictment. It just came to light here. According to the Bergen Record, then Menendez's girlfriend, Nadine, hit and killed a man with her car in Bergoda up in Bergen County back in December of 2018. The man was attempting to cross the street. He was just by his home when Menendez came down the road and hit him. He died almost instantly, and she called 911. Now, the man's family is accusing her of waiting several minutes to call 911. She has not been charged in this instance, so it's important to note that. And that's because police say that, it was just an accident. Now, this comes to light. Now, here's the reason why it comes to light. It is as a result of the most recent indictment against her and her husband. So it's a part of it that the indictment is what triggered it. Now you're probably saying, what does one have to do with the other? And why is it that the indictment is triggering this and why this didn't trigger the indictment? Let me explain. So the indictment claims she received a new 2019 Mercedes-Benz as a result of an accident where she didn't have a car, that she needed a new car. She was at one, and that she had this accident, according to the indictment, around the same time this one happened. You notice a pattern there? That she hit this guy, she killed him accidentally. The car was damaged because, as you know, anyone who's hit a deer by accident knows it destroys your whole front of the car. It's quite a mess to try and repair. So hitting a person, that's a whole different animal there. Not trying to put a pun on words, but that's just the way it is. It literally is a whole different dimension to that. So the car was damaged. She needed a new one. So what happens there? Well, Menendez gets a little favor. So he does a favor for his business associates. He tries to get some time shaken off a possible indictment and a plea deal. He talks to some of the attorneys. And as a result, his wife gets a 2019 Mercedes. She even put it into him over text. And she was the girlfriend at the time, too. She wasn't even a Menendez yet. She says, congratulations, we got a 2019 Mercedes. So she got the car. That's what the prosecutors are saying, that this accident happened. We have it on the record. It did. Because that car, out of the picture, she needed a new car. Car mysteriously shows up in driveway, which they took the pictures of when they did the raid of the house. And that car is registered around that time. That is the case that the prosecution is trying to put together here, and that they think this is an important piece of that puzzle. And again, the Bergen Record is the one first reporting this. That it's kind of out there, but like really didn't get much attention, which is kind of interesting because this was just a month after Menendez got a double-digit victory over Bob Hugin, the Republican. He was a multimillionaire, put a lot of money in this campaign, going after Menendez, questioning his credibility, especially after the last indictment, because he just got over that, just got the victory, was in the Holy Land there, feeling good. And then this happens a month later. So it is interesting that didn't get the coverage. But again, it really didn't get, because of the Bergen Record in North Jersey, really doing the digging and the evidence, we got to see it. We're going to have to see how that plays in. Is that going to be a key part? Does that validate their case? Does a jury see the connection? Okay, hit car. Then we need to get new car. Oh, well, it happened around this time that there just happens to be a guy who needs a favor, and he happens to be able to get a car. Oh, I got a new car. I didn't have a payment on the car. The car just got here, and then there's a picture of the car in the driveway. Maybe something shady happened. We'll have to see if the prosecution can make that argument to a jury and if they believe it. Now, there's a lot to get to here, believe it or not. That isn't what we just talked about. Here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. We're nearly 2 years away from the next gubernatorial election here in this state, and the race is already heating up. One candidate on the Democratic side has already entered the race. Jersey City Mayor Steve Fuller. He's already raised a massive $3 million since he announced in April. That means he has reached the maximum amount required to receive matching funds as part of the state's campaign program. Now, the campaign funding program, let me explain how this works. So, under New Jersey financing laws, the state can match every dollar a candidate raises with $2. If you do that quick math for a second, you'll get to the fact that this brings Fuller's grand total to more than $7.3 million. What does that say in terms of a guy who's already in there? And he's already racking up the endorsements too. This would make him the fastest candidate to ever reach that milestone in state history. But he most certainly is not going to be the only one in this race, as multiple Democrats are considering jumping in this race. On the Republican side, former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli has already made it clear that he plans to jump in and run for governor once again. Joining me now is Democratic gubernatorial candidate and Jersey City Mayor Steve Fuller. Mayor Fuller, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Joey.
You're currently running for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination here in New Jersey. What made you decide to run?
Well, you know, I've been the mayor now for 12 years, and I've learned a lot about municipal government, what works and what doesn't work. And that's a different perspective coupled with my military experience and my private sector. I think Jersey City has been a success story. And you layer all those things together, and then you look at kind of the direction of New Jersey overall and whether it's going to be a livable place for my kids and future generations. And so, you know, there may be a little bit of a selfish component in the fact that I think about my kids' future, but it also everybody's kids' futures and kind of what New Jersey will look like. Is it going to be the same great place that I grew up in? And, you know, unless some changes happen, I think that the answer could be no.
Now, you, interesting enough, have announced pretty early in this process, earlier than usual. The typical standpoint for gubernatorial candidates is that they let the state legislative races come and go. You know, typically that's considered the governor's midterm election, so you say. And then after that, they'll surely announce. But you got in before that. Why did you jump in so early?
So it's a good question. The reality is that like New Jersey does something different than most states in how the ballot's laid out. And it creates a situation where a small group of people have the opportunity to pick a lot of the elected positions in a way that's fairly undemocratic. And in order to have the opportunity to be a viable campaign, regardless of whether the political organization or structure supports or doesn't support, whether it be viable to take it to the people, it takes time. It takes fundraising, it takes substance on policies and organizing. And so you can't do that in 2 months or 6 months even. It takes time. So we started early, and the first 5 months have been better than I could have imagined.
You call the system in New Jersey that's in place undemocratic, which you're referring to the county organizational line system, where basically there's 21 counties, and for each, whether it's the Republican or Democrat, in your case, Democrat, you have to compete for the party's endorsement for favorable ballot preference for their preferred candidate. There has been some movement, especially in the state legislature, to get rid of this. They want to abolish this county organizational line system. There's also some cases in the courts right now. As governor, would you push to abolish the county organizational line if the legislature...
I mean, I'd like to work, like, to get elected. I have no choice. I'm going to work within the structure. But I think long term, you know, I think the only option for New Jersey to be a great place is that you need to reform how elections happen. And the line structure is not the best for engaging people. So I think changing that and creating a better system is important and in the best interest of New Jersey. So, yeah, I'd be supportive of changing that. And I've been clear. Look, I've been a candidate that's won and ran outside of that traditional political system. And, you know, at the same time, I have a lot of relationships inside it. But to me, the most important thing is how do you energize, engage the most people possible? And I think that the line structure fairly tends to disenfranchise a lot of people. And so change is important.
As you would expect, you're not going to be the only person to jump into this race by any means.
Yep.
Former State Senate President Steve Sweeney and Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill are rumored to be possible contenders for the nomination. They both have deep pockets with many connections to donors between the two of them. How do you plan to overcome that?
Well, look, I think time and structure and organization is what's going to carry the day. So I have a track record that's unique relative to those two and most other potential candidates, being that Jersey City has been a renaissance story like no other. Being an executive is a different narrative than both of those. And from my standpoint, look, when I ran for mayor, I ran outside of the traditional political structure and few people thought I would win. And we organized the same sort of way and it worked out fine. And I think we're going to do the same thing. So I believe that I am the best candidate for the job. I believe that I have the best experience for the job. I believe that I could change New Jersey for the better. And so we're all in on this, regardless of what the landscape looks like.
You consider yourself a progressive. Sherrill and Sweeney are closer to the center than you are. Now, New Jersey, though considered a blue state, is pretty moderate when it comes to state and local offices. Are you worried that your policy positions may be out of line with the voters you need to win the state?
I don't know, because I don't get so into the labels, because at the end of the day, I have such an extensive track record because I'm the mayor of a city like Jersey City. So whether it's dealing with the immigrant community or economic development or military issues or health and human services issues, I think my track record is pretty clear and vast. And I don't think it's easy to put into one camp or bucket. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a track record of success. So you label it how you want to label it. But I think when you point to the different parts of the success story in Jersey City, it's going to be hard to find anybody that has a competitive story like we do.
One thing that you pushed for during your time as mayor is green energy, to get renewable energy sources to move the city, and now you're looking to move the state more towards a clean energy system as opposed to fossil fuels. Governor Murphy is looking for New Jersey to go all electric by 2035, meaning you wouldn't be able to purchase a gas-powered car in the state. Would that time frame be your goal as governor?
Look, he has different data than I do with regards to why he chose that timeline and what type of tools he has to encourage it. What I've generally found is that you want to use the carrot as opposed to the stick. You don't want to be punitive or threaten people. You want to educate them and entice them to show that there are better options than maybe what they did today or have today. Today, there's not enough infrastructure in New Jersey to accommodate that number of electric vehicles. So, you know, a place like Jersey City, we're moving all of our electric towards electrifying them because we've built the infrastructure or are building the infrastructure. If New Jersey doesn't have the infrastructure or a governor committed to it, all of these kind of platitudes around 2030, 2050, 2035 mean nothing. So for me, it's a couple things. First, you got to build the infrastructure before you could set a realistic target. And then B, you need to encourage people with proper incentives. And then three, you need to educate them. And unless all of those three things are happening, it's not going to be realistic to achieve.
Now, it sounds like 2035, you say, may be a little too ambitious. But what year would you put it? Would it be 2050?
Well,
do you think it's...
You know, I don't know if it's ambitious or not. I mean, it really depends on kind of how the program is structured and set up. And, you know, Governor Murphy's going to be gone in 2 years. So it's really going to be up to the next governor on how he sets up that infrastructure and how he uses the budget as a tool to get there. So, you know, maybe you could do it sooner. Maybe you could do it later. I can't tell you. But I think that the goal of moving towards a more environmentally conscious policy initiatives is important. And so, like, I think how you get there is important too, but the objective that he has is the right one. It's just how do you do it? And I don't know if we have the infrastructure yet to do it, but it's going to fall on the next governor anyway.
So you like the idea of going all electric, but you don't seem to like the mandated thing. What would be that incentive to you? Is it just simply educating?
Well, it's educating. I think that you're using financial incentives. You need to use tools to give people a financial incentive to make a change from what they're traditionally comfortable with to kind of a different paradigm, right? So like you can't just order them or mandate or restrict them. People will push back. You need to educate on why it's better for them and then create a financial incentive that people clearly understand. So like any policy in 2025 through 2035 needs to be focused on building the infrastructure and then educating people and then giving them an incentive to do it. Because that's just the way that it's realistic that you're going to get there. Requiring and mandating thing without any sort of education or incentive, you're going to get massive pushback from people. That's just the reality of how people are.
Cars aren't the only thing that we're looking to go green on. A number of wind farms are set to be built off the coast of the Jersey Shore. There's a new proposal by a New York-based company called Attentive Energy, which would build windmills 42 miles off the coast of Seaside Heights. The company said this would be the furthest project off the East Coast yet and would power 600,000 homes. Now, this is on top of recent polling showing support for wind projects in New Jersey has dropped to 50% after being at 80% back in 2019. Republicans and some environmentalists have claimed that offshore wind has led to multiple whale deaths over the last year or so. The federal government and Governor Murphy have denied such a connection. But given these concerns by residents, particularly those who live down the shore, should we pump the brakes on these projects?
Look, I think the narrative, unfortunately, has spun away from the governor and his team, whether it's more resources against wind energy on the education front or a lack of education on the governor's side, because it's unfortunate, like a lot of misinformation that's out there. Now, do I think that there are certain components of the current program that I would like to adjust? Of course. I think that the visibility from the shore is a problem and you need to address that. I think that what the cost of to the ratepayer, which I've seen a whole range of numbers, is obviously concerning because you want to make sure that there's minimal impact. You want to make sure that it powers the most number of houses possible. So would I have a fresh eyes in looking at the program? Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Again, I think the goal always is to go towards renewable energy. So that is the objective. But I think you got to do it in a way that you bring along people, which actually hasn't happened here. To see the polling numbers decrease the way they have and the public support means that the narrative, unfortunately, has spun entirely away from them.
You talk about narrative and that, again, going back to what you said about the electric cars, the key is education and incentives. Now, the legislature did approve some incentives for these projects to be built, but they're looking for more incentives. Yeah. As governor, would you sign on to getting more tax incentives for these companies?
I think there's some concerns over those incentives because I think there's been a lot of questions over the viability of those corporations that have gotten them. Some of them international corporations. Who do they employ? How many people? What's the impact going to be on the actual end ratepayer? Those are all valid questions that people are bringing up. So, like, again, fresh eyes when you get in there. I don't think ever it's an open checkbook that you just can write any amount of money that somebody demands for. So I think you need to have a real assessment of kind of what makes sense on this sort of stuff. And I think that's fair. And I think residents in New Jersey would understand that. And I think the environmentalists would understand that because I'm a supporter and my track record is strong on supporting all policies that deal and confront with climate change, but you got to do it in a responsible way, and education is important.
But at the end of the day, you think that these windmill projects should ultimately take place in some form at some point?
I think, again, that's like a big variable, some form, some point, right? I think that you brought up yourself questions around the tax incentives and the structures. I brought up what the impact is to the ratepayer at the end of the day, because you've seen a huge range of potential numbers around that. And then, of course, you know, the Jersey Shore is a tremendous asset that we have. I've read and heard a lot of different numbers as far as how far off the shore you can place them in order to have no or minimal impact. And I think those are things that I would need to reconsider and consider.
Now, obviously, we're talking about tax incentives here, but taxes are a big issue in the state, particularly property taxes amongst New Jersey voters. Governor Murphy has signed a couple initiatives into law to battle the property tax burden in this state. Stay NJ and the Anchor Program are the two that come to mind the most. Republicans have criticized these programs, calling them gimmicks. Do you see these as effective programs?
Well, I mean, the stay in jail program is not in place yet, so it's hard to kind of quantify what the impact has been or will be until everything is set up on it. I think, by and large, there's a lot of incentive programs that are very, very confusing and not easily accessible for most residents. So I think streamlining and organizing is part of it. Okay, and then I think you really need to have a real comprehensive conversation around affordability, and that entails housing prices, that entails taxes. Living in New Jersey overall, like, people like to point to the tax issue, but it's not only the tax issue. It's also the lack of affordable housing or market rate housing, because the lack of housing forces somebody who's looking for a $500,000 home to maybe buy a $600,000 home and live a little bit beyond their means. And that affordability conversation impacts every component of their life in perpetuity then. So there's a lot of nuances to this. It's not just taxes. Taxes is one part of it, and we'll deal with it, but it's also housing. It deals with transportation. They all layer in to making New Jersey an expensive place to live, which is a challenge.
You brought up transportation. You recently came out in favor of the congestion tax pricing that is going to be implemented in the spring. You said that on an interview with News 12 New Jersey, that you think this is more targeted at a 3% of New Jerseyans, more wealthier New Jerseyans, that doesn't really affect the bottom line. But my question to you is that if you're talking about affordability, and there are a lot of people that have to commute to work, especially those who are coming over from Jersey City, where you are now mayor, is that a harder burden than now families? Because you don't think so.
No. First of all, I said that the first step is that, you know, we need to be doing congestion pricing on New York drivers when they come here as well. I mean, we're a corridor state. People travel through us all the time. People commute into New Jersey, and we should be doing the same thing to them because it's a regional solution. That's number one. Number two is congestion pricing has been shown to work. It's good for the environment, and it's good for minimizing congestion, and we are a very, very congested state. By doing congestion pricing on New York in a regional approach, you could have another revenue stream to pay for mass transit like trains and buses, which most people use. Really, people who are fighting the congestion pricing conversation are fighting for the 3% of the population that afford to drive their car every day into Midtown Manhattan for work. That is not an everyday type person. The buses that we're talking about going into the tunnels are exempt from paying this sort of fee. So from my standpoint, it's basically a question of, are you comfortable with a tax on the wealthiest 3% of the people in exchange for having better infrastructure, better buses, better trains for the other 97%? And are you willing to have New Yorkers chip in to pay for New Jersey infrastructure? And if your answer is yes, then you should be supportive of the plan that I'm saying.
Now, you're obviously someone who's very invested in transportation. You say that these congestion taxes could ultimately pay to help resolve some of the issues, especially over at NJ Transit, where, you know, the governor's saying, well, you know, things are better than ever. But a rally, you'll notice, especially with the most recent flooding that occurred, you know, a week ago, where people were stranded and having to deal with all this and that. And then there's, you know, trains getting canceled every 5 seconds, it seems like. How would you fix NJ Transit to finally get this to where it's a functional transportation system that everyday New Jerseyans can rely on?
I think there's a couple of things. I think, first of all, you need a dedicated revenue source. I think I've outlined that very clearly in our policy proposal. I think number two is you need to look at how the bus routes have been privatized over time, and you realize that that's not in the best interest of the riders. Number three, you need to invest in the system so that people feel it's safe and reliable, so that way they're willing to take it. Right now, you have a system that is not invested in, people don't feel comfortable with, so you would never rely on it if you have an urgent place to be. And all of those dynamics need to shift. So for me, it starts with a dedicated revenue stream and professionalizing a lot of the different routes away from the private operators on the bus side, and then investing in the train stations as well in order to modernize them and make them feel a place that people want to be.
Now, I know we're running low on time here, but I do want to get you on a couple of other subjects. Moving on to abortion, that's a hot topic in the state. And it's been for a number of years. Governor Murphy signed last year the Freedom of Reproductive Choice Act, codifying the procedure into state law. Republicans have called this too extreme due to the fact that the current law on the books doesn't put any restrictions on abortion. Your party wanted to go further than that by attempting to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would enshrine it into the state constitution. Ultimately, that did not get brought up for a vote in the state legislature. But in your view, is an amendment to the New Jersey state constitution necessary in order to keep the procedure legal?
I don't know if it's necessary, but I'd be supportive of it. I think that at the end of the day, you realize that from a national standpoint, that women's reproductive rights are under attack. There's no question about that. And I firmly believe that it's a decision between a woman and her doctor, and that's it. And I think that protecting that is important. I think Governor Murphy has done a good job around this issue. I think that, you know, Governor Murphy deserves credit for this. So that's kind of how I feel.
What about this criticism by Republicans saying that, oh, you know, Democrats, they don't support any restrictions on this. They want 9-month abortion. They want partial birth.
No, like I said, I think where Governor Murphy has kind of been on this is consistent with most of New Jersey. And I, you know, it's not worth getting into all the talking points for like Republicans that people are supportive of, you know, at 9 months terminating a pregnancy and this and that. I don't think Governor Murphy or the state legislature has said anything about that. And I think if you read the Reproductive Freedom of Reproductive Act that they passed this year, it doesn't speak to any of that stuff. So it's just silly to like go back and forth on that. But codifying it was important, and I think they did a good job.
Last thing before I let you go. Obviously, everyone's been talking about Senator Bob Menendez and his wife getting indicted on bribery charges. You've never really been a big fan of his. And there are already people starting to think about a possible, you know, possible entry into primarying him. You've praised Congressman Andy Kim as he challenges Senator Bob Menendez for his seat next year. There's other Democrats who are considering jumping into this primary,
yep,
including New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy, who you've also offered some praise for.
Yep. Yep.
Who would you like to see be the Democratic nominee for Senate next year?
I want to go back into what I said earlier. I just want to see a robust primary, a fair primary, and good options for New Jersey voters. So if you have Tammy Murphy and Andy Kim and others in there, I think that's good. You know, you'll have people with credibility and substance and a track record. And I think that makes a better political system. So, you know, it's not today that I have a favorite candidate. It's really hard to select somebody who hasn't really declared yet. But, you know, we'll see where it goes. And I'm optimistic because you have some people raising their hand and saying, I'm going to engage.
But it's not going to be Senator Menendez if he runs and gets the nomination.
No. That's pretty clear. I mean, I don't think that there's any circumstances where I could be supportive of him. I mean, I've had a hard time with him. I primaried him 20 years ago, and you know, I've obviously had challenges with him, you know, personally and professionally for the better part of 20 years. So, you know, my track record is pretty clear on that.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there and see where your campaign goes. Democratic gubernatorial candidate and Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Joey, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Well, that about wraps things up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on, all you have to do is follow me on social media. You can do it on X, which is formerly Twitter, @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram @joey.block.39. Again, that is @joey.block.39. Now, if you just found us for the first time, you're like, oh my God, I love this show. It's so great, but where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You got to go to that browser of yours. You got to type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You put that in. It's going to take you right to the podcast page where all the Fox Sports New Jersey podcasts are. You're going to scroll down until you find in the middle Joey Block. You're going to click on that. And all the episodes will be there. We have the newest ones at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Thank you so much for listening this week. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.